You're listening to a message from Oaks Church Brooklyn. Our longing is to see heaven come to earth in our city. For more information on our church and community, please visit oaksbk.church.
Daughters and sons make daughters and sons, all while Pharaoh counts their heads. There are too many them and too little us. There is plenty, but for all his might, Pharaoh is scared, so he seeks security in the Nile. One by one, the Hebrews lose their sons, just as they lost their freedom. But unto them a child is born, plucked from the water. He is a man on fire, headed to the desert in desperate need of saving. This is the story of God.
There are some new faces, and it's good to see you. I'm Patrick, one of the pastors here. I would love to get to know you more. I would tell you something about myself, you'll find. I would like to fancy myself a student of history and poetry. There are two things that I really love. And I love when they meet each other. And there's actually this poem that I found so intriguing and thought-provoking. And I want to read it to you. It's from a Nigerian-British poet named Ben Okri. It's called Diallo's Testament, and it was written in reflection on this portrait of a man named Ayuba Suleiman Diallo. This guy. So this is the portrait that inspired this poem. Who can read the riddle of life in this portrait of mine? I am one on whom providence has worked its magic reversals. Behind me are silent stories. Like a storm, I have worn history round my neck like chains. Freedom is a difficult lesson to learn. I have tasted the language of death till it became the water of life. I have shaped a little canvas of time. I have crossed seas of fires and seen with these African eyes the one light which neither empires nor all the might of men obscure. Man is the sickness, God the cure. I found this poem fascinating for a lot of reasons, but chiefly it's actually the muse of this poem, Ayuba. Ayuba was an African prince born in what is now modern day like Senegal in the early 1700s, like 1701. And one day, this African prince is captured by his enemies, his head shaven so that his nobility is masked, and he's sold into slavery. And he goes from the throne room to the bottom of a boat, the Arabella, and is sent to America across the Middle Passage. And so he finds himself there. He ends up sold into slavery in Maryland. And for 2 years, he is a slave until he runs away. He runs away from his enslaver. He's caught and captured soon after, and he's sent back. And when he returns, he writes a letter. Senegal is primarily, and Bundu at that time was primarily Muslim, and so he writes a letter in Arabic to his father, asking him to come save him, to rescue him, and he gives it to his enslaver. And somehow, this letter makes its way from Maryland to the hands of aristocrats in England who get it translated, hear the cries of this man, arrange the security of his freedom, have him sent back to England, where he ends up dining with like the queen and the king of England, and then ends up back home. You see what I'm saying? This is wild. How do you write your way out of slavery? And so when I look at that portrait, when I read Okri's poem, when I consider this man's life, it's so provocative to me because it raises these questions like what is the feeling of going from thriving to the brink of surviving? Like, what prayers do you pray, and what songs do you sing, and what is your relationship to a God who both allows you to be sold into slavery and then uses a letter written in Arabic placed in the hands of your southern enslaver to free you to dine with the Queen of England? How do you make sense of all of that? What kind of God is telling the story? Well, if you are new here, we are in this journey that is going to take us some time to get through, where we are moving through the scriptures in what we call the story of God. And essentially, we are approaching the Bible through its narrative arc, tracing the movement and the presence and the activity of God and the world, and just seeing what the story provokes, what it nourishes, what it confronts, what it stimulates within us. We started, obviously, in the garden, and from there we went to Eve and her sons, and then from them to Noah and his sons, and then we landed on a man named Abraham who was given a covenant or a promise from God, both that he would have children that would outnumber the stars and that they would exist and thrive in a land that God would show them. Now, Abraham passes this on to his son, Isaac. Isaac passes it on to one of his two sons, Jacob. Jacob gets the ball rolling, and he has 12 sons. The 11th of which, Joseph, has a life that kind of feels like the IP for a Yuba story. He, too, has the story of going from greatness to slavery to these high of heights. And then, as the story goes, these children of Abraham, these people of this covenant, they just experience immense thriving. They move through famine, and they're growing at such an incredible rate. More and more sons and daughters are coming. And all this is happening while they are in Egypt. And so if you think about it, this was actually not the land that they were supposed to be led to. And so they're the right people. We're building a nation, but we're in the wrong place. And there's this Pharaoh who's in charge of Egypt. And after some time where all the goodwill, Joseph, this Hebrew-born second in command of Egypt, he is long gone, and with him are all his stories, and no one remembers him, but all they see is what's left, which is his massive family spreading throughout the land. And in view of that, the story goes, Pharaoh says, "Look, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." And so the Egyptians follow Pharaoh's order, and they begin to enslave the Israelite people. And these people that were once thriving are now placed under forced servitude, and yet they keep thriving. They keep having more and more children. And Pharaoh just gets more and more agitated. There's this thing with, like, escalation. You know, as a parent, and if you are a parent or if you've been adjacent to a parent, then maybe you've seen something like that, where when you get a little scared, like my kid was like hanging off of our stationary bike, and he's like hanging off of the front because it's like really fun, and he's also incredibly strong. But all I see is his bike tipping over and landing on him. And so I'm too far to grab him. And so I'm just like, hey, don't do that. Hey, please stop. Hey, and he's not listening. And so my fear meets me wanting him to do what I want him to do. And that just keeps ratcheting up until we're on the brink of violence. And I'm like, if that thing falls on you and crushes you, I'm going to murder you. Like, get off the bike. Like, that's the thing about mixing fear with power. It makes a pretty bitter drink. It's a deadly cocktail. Same is true for Pharaoh. His fear meets his power, and as these people keep thriving, as he keeps escalating, he finally gets to the point where he says, you know what? We're gonna have to cut this off at the root. And so he calls these two midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, and they are the midwives of the Hebrew people, and he tells them, hey, here's what you're gonna do. Every time that you deliver a Hebrew child, when you see that it is a boy, I want you to kill him. It's interesting though, these two women, they get this directive, and as the story goes, it says, the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. See, that's the thing about mixing fear and God's power. Like, it becomes an elixir for whatever ails you. So God allows his people to keep thriving. I think it's worth noting just the small tidbit in the story that I find so fascinating about the cluelessness of men when it comes to women's bodies and like the foolishness of othering, because when clearly the kids aren't dying, it says that Pharaoh calls these two ladies back in and he's like, what's going on? And they're like, oh, the Hebrew women, they just give birth really fast. They do it before we even get there. And he's like, oh, that sounds right. All right, cool. Like, amazing. So the Israelites, they continue to grow and to flourish, and Pharaoh continues to grow anxious and insecure, and then he makes a decree that's really gonna set in motion more than he ever could have bargained for. Now, instead of relying on the Hebrews to do his dirty work, he turns to all Egyptians, and he issues a decree that any Hebrew boy that they see should be killed on sight, should be thrown into the Nile. Who can read the riddle of life in this portrait of mine? I am the one on whom providence has worked its magic reversals. There's a woman in this story, Jochebed, and I'm so fascinated by her. She married this man named Amram, and thinking of my own wedding day, I think of all the excitement that those days carry and all the hopes and the ideas and the dreams, children and thriving. They were a people among a thriving people in a beautiful place. And I think about Jochebed when she has her first child, which is a daughter named Miriam. And like how, I wonder if she noticed that Miriam had the same bravery that she had. And then there was Aaron. He was the second born, but the first son. And we don't know how long it was after Aaron was born that the decree came to kill the Hebrew boys. But I can just imagine the beauty of having her little girl and her son, and the joy that would bring this family. And then the decree comes that any other boys would be murdered. And if I could ask her something, I would ask her, when she got pregnant for the third time, what was in her heart and her mind? Like, did she dare hope for another son? Or did she just pray for another daughter that she wouldn't have to maybe witness her baby boy breathing his last? Like, parents aren't supposed to do that. And then I wonder when Pua or Shifra, when they pulled the child from her and they told her that it was a boy, like, was there dread? We can't know. But we do know that if there was any sorrow in Jochebed, it didn't stay long. And it wasn't because of him, her new boy. Because she thought he was a fine child. At least that's how the story goes. It says that when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. And then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. Her sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. That was the decree of Pharaoh. Jochebed knew this. 3 months, she loved her son as best she could, and then she had to obey. But she was very shrewd, because she realized Pharaoh said, you had to throw the babies into the Nile, but he didn't say how. Honestly, it could have been Miriam's plan. She is incredibly quick-witted. She's good on her feet in all the ways. She follows her brother, and when he's plucked from the basket by none other than the princess of Egypt, Miriam quickly says, would you like me to go get a lady to take care of that baby for you? I wonder if there was some sort of like April Fool's equivalent during this time. Because I just imagine Jochebed, when she's home, having pushed her son down the river, and in comes her daughter saying, hey, I need you to go to the palace. And she goes from making what she hopes will be an ark of salvation for her little one, that maybe he will find his way out of Egypt, and before he is taken by the alligators, before he succumbs to exposure, that maybe some kind stranger would find him and have pity on him. She pushes him away, and next thing she knows, he's being placed back in her hands by the princess of Egypt, her fugitive son. And she's asked to raise him with compensation. Reversals of fortune. Moses is what the prince named him because she plucked him from the water. And those are the waters he was supposed to drown in. But they became the waters that saved him. But saved by the hands of the family that damned him and sent him there in the first place, only to place him in the hands that set him on that water, but are now the ones to raise him. There's a topsy-turviness that defines the life of Moses that we will explore in the weeks to come. He's loved by those who hate him. He's hated by those who love him. He's a man trapped between two cultures, two empires, the banks of a mighty river. And maybe you could imagine all the emotions that were dammed up in him. All the chaos flooding his body and his mind and his soul. And what does that do to a person? It's not that rage is when all the feelings move and stampede out at once. One day, as a young prince of Egypt, Moses, he sees a Hebrew being accosted and roughed up by this Egyptian, and something just breaks in him. All the things flow out. The dam crumbles, and in his rage, he kills the Egyptian, and he buries his body. The very next day, he sees two Hebrews arguing, and that temper, that streak of justice, that thing that just wants things to be right in the world, it wells up in him, and he confronts the person in the wrong, only to have his freshly laid secret dug up and thrown in his face. The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Who made Moses ruler indeed?" The word is out. Moses has killed a man. Pharaoh seeks to end his life. And the baby boy sent afloat on the water in the hopes that he may live is now a man running into the desert out of the fear that he may die. And we'll see what he finds there next week. As is our custom during this series, as we tell a story, we'd like to just make space for any questions that may arise. Any questions from today's excerpt from the story? Please. Yes, it was all of the Hebrew boys, not just the firstborn sons. So Exodus 1:22, every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. And so it's population control. Spoiler alert. Yeah. Yeah, so Amanda's question is essentially, there are these motifs in the Bible, and so what do you make of the motifs? Like, is this like a literary function? Is this like cultural artifacts? Like, how do the same things like keep on happening and seem to have great importance? Great question. One, I'm not a scholar on ancient Mesopotamia. I do read a lot. So I can't speak with full authority on the cultural milieus of the time. But I can say throughout history, right, population control, like, has been a thing. Like, you see that, yeah, here, you see it with Herod, you see it in Nazi Germany, like, you just see, like, it's... So to your question about, like, why would you not just kill the warriors? But turns out that, like, artist men can have warrior sons, you know? And so root and stem was kind of the Nazi slogan, which is cut them off at the root. You look at the transatlantic slave trade, and the first things that happened when people got off the ships is that they were separated from their families. They were broken down, and men were subjugated. It doesn't have quite a tinge of logic to it, because it's not based on logic. It's based on desperation and fear. And that is the motif. Now, so when we look at the things, you know, I would take us to Ecclesiastes, where the writer says, there is nothing new under the sun. We find like different flavors to eat the same bitter ice cream, you know, like we just keep finding ways to be inhuman to each other. And so there always is some kind of built-in sense of, yeah, like familiarness to this. You know what I'm saying? That's how I read it. And so I think these events happened. And I also, the last thing I will say to that question is, leads to the point of why we're moving through the story narratively. Because when you do that, you kind of realize, man, this feels like almost as something, someone's like almost authoring this. Like someone's almost behind the scenes making way and taking advantage of situations so that when something comes, you'll be able to know what you're seeing. Any other questions? Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so Stevie asks, where are the dads at in this story? So to be fair, in Exodus 1 and 2, we don't get the names of either Amram or Jochebed. That comes in like Exodus 6, and that only comes after there's this kind of genealogy that's been given that's kind of establishing who the people are. It happens again in Numbers, and it's just kind of giving you the writers are trying to help us remember who belongs to who. But in Exodus 2, we don't actually get their names. It just says their tribe, there's a Levi man, marries a Levi woman. And I think the purpose of that is because it's actually not necessarily about them. I centered Jochebed because I'm just fascinated by her and these kind of people that are like so important to these stories. But in the scriptures, I think the for those writing the story and who they're writing it for, they want you to focus on Moses for reasons to be discovered. Right? But I think because we're an storied people, if you really want the fullness of Moses' story, which is probably quite familiar to all of you, it behooves us to look at the story that informs Moses' story so that we can really see what it means for this young man. Like, what does it mean to be like, again, decreed by a Pharaoh that ends up kind of becoming your grandfather? And then your mom has to send you away, but then she raises you, but then you're taken from her. Like, what would that do inside of you? Right? Like, people don't just snap and kill people and bury their bodies unless you're really angry. And I think Moses has reasons to be really, really angry. Yeah, Robbie, I'll end with you. Ooh, okay. I mean, I'm not gonna call you that guy, but we can talk about it. We can talk, yeah, I mean, I seeded it. Unto them a child is born. We're trying to hold the dramatic tension, right? Obviously, Moses is a proto-Jesus, right? To Amanda's point, babies, boys being killed, and one survives and one comes through. It all motif, but if you jump to Jesus, right? Hopefully this story isn't like that shocking or surprising to any of you. You kind of know where we're going. But I think there's something that's going to be unlocked within us as we do the slow, meticulous journey of learning how we get to Jesus and what all Jesus means and what he means to the people that kill him, right? And what does it mean for people to have, who have, were flourishing and then they're out of power? Like, this moment is seminal. These next, like, 6 weeks that we're going to be in the Exodus itself shapes the whole cultural ethos of the Israelite people to today. And so we have to not rush past it, because also it'll make sense why what you do with Jesus then in light of the Exodus is so pivotal for how you move in the world. Because what Jesus does is he fulfills a promise of land and people that both frees you from the material and also allows you to have a better relationship with it. But without Jesus, what are you left with but remnants of the scars of collective oppression? And what does that do to a people? And what will those people do to not be there again?